Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. In a world plagued by natural and man-made disasters, international conflict, and economic crises, what values will leaders have to bring to the table to forge lasting solutions? And are there solutions out there that simply haven't occurred yet to the people in charge? Wanting his students to gain an understanding of the complexity of global politics, but also of the consequences of policy decisions on real human beings, teacher John Hunter has spent decades perfecting an extremely complex classroom exercise he calls the World Peace Game. Working in teams representing four fictitious countries, students seek solutions to 50 interlocking problems with the environment, the economy, public health, civil unrest, and international disputes, and can only win when they have solved every one and improved the financial well-being of all countries involved. While those problems would baffle even postgraduate-level students, Hunter has discovered they inspire remarkable insight and growth even when presented to 9- and 10-year-olds. John Hunter writes about what he has taught and learned over several decades in the classroom in his new book, World Peace and Other Fourth-Grade Achievements. We've invited him as part of KERA's American Graduate Initiative. John, welcome to Think.
Hi, thank you for having me. Happy to be here.
So your mom was a teacher, and one of the first things she taught you was to go find answers for yourself.
That's right. She would always just pause and create this sort of space between us rather than rushing to an answer or guidance or instruction. And I thought it was odd, but it allowed me just a few moments to self-reflect and to find the answer or allow the answer to emerge. And that became a sort of a habit in our family to allow this space for things to appear rather than trying to superimpose our own presuppositions on things.
It's almost like, you know, with young people and children in particular, they need to know that we trust them to find the answers.
That's right. I think trust is a fundamental thing. And when students feel that you trust them as a teacher, that you have respect for them and their ideas, you know, I had a mentor who told me to always look for the LOLR with students. I said, what's that? He said, the line of least resistance. Find out what they love, what they really deeply care about, what means something to them, and then build curriculum to and around that. And you'll have their passion driving the learning, and it becomes much more successful that way.
You write, John, about the ideal classroom as a place full of both emptiness and fullness. Can you talk about what that means?
Oh, yes. You know, in today's, test-driven society, we have an idea that we must fill every minute. We have to quantify every step and every minute of our time and our investment. And I think the idea we have in the World Peace Game and in my classroom is that we allow space for reflection, and we try essentially to slow things down, to allow children to really come to grips with problems in a deeper, more meaningful way, to allow critical thinking to really play out fully rather than rushing to a solution to fill in a test bubble or to come up with a first pick of the teacher hands up kind of situation. So that space complements the fullness of their ideas, their minds, their interests, their loves, their passions. So you have a sort of balance. You know, you're going full tilt with everybody engaged, everybody up and talking, negotiating, and working in the World Peace Game. And then we come to a pause. We read Sun Tzu's The Art of War, basically how to stay out of it or how to avoid it altogether. And then we pause for a moment and allow that to sink in and students to interpret it in their own ways.
Yeah, let's talk about the art of war, because it seems like something that is that would be way above the heads of, say, fourth graders. but you want them to understand not just how to wage war, but why it happens.
Yeah, well, you know, they brought it to me. I didn't have that in the game years ago. And a student came in and said, you know, my mom is a businesswoman, and she reads this every night. She says it's really good for business. And this child happened to be an arms dealer in the game. So they brought it in and shared it. And, of course, I took it to the students. I asked them what they thought. And they discussed it, they looked it over, they read through it, and decided to incorporate it in the game. So we voted, and it's become a part of the game from here on. It's very simple, short epigrams, but they really deal with a deeper, complex understanding about the nature of existence and the nature of life. I mean, Sun Tzu was a Chinese general from 2,500 years ago who really had a grip on living, not just warfare and dying. And the students really see that. They get that. It's an amazing thing to see them take their little pocket copies that they end up getting by the end of the game experience, take them out on the playground and sitting under a tree and opening up, a nine-year-old opening up Art of War and reading during recess. So yeah, we have that.
So talk about how the first iteration of what is now the World Peace Game came into existence.
Mm. Well, you know, it started in an odd sort of way. I had my first job interview, and my supervisor in Richmond, Virginia, Richmond Public Schools, I asked her, what should I do, when it was apparent I was going to be hired? They had a shortage that year, I guess. And she said to me, what do you want to do? And that question unseated everything. It stopped me cold. You know, I was expecting a mandate. I was expecting her to give me a manual to tell me what to do. I wanted to know what to do, do it right, correctly. But she essentially turned me back in on myself, much as my mother had done, creating an empty space. And as a young idealistic teacher, of course, I rushed to fill that space. But the nice thing was, my mentor, Ms. Ethel J. Banks, talked about that LOLR, line of least resistance. And she said, you know, find out what their passion is and let that drive their curriculum. And in 1978, we didn't have Facebook, we didn't have Twitter. We had board games. And I realized they loved this ninth grade class of inner cities kids in a gifted school love board games. So I decided to incorporate that in the curriculum as their passion would drive. And then I also wanted to teach what was required, which in that case was Africa. We had to do a social studies unit. And problem solving had just been a new cutting edge technology in 1978. So I put that in too and sort of did a mashup, I guess, if you will, of those things. And that was the first world peace game on a 4-foot by 5-foot plywood board in my ninth grade history class in Richmond, Virginia.
I think what's so fascinating about the approach that you take, John, is that rather than focusing on the sort of what and why and what and where facts, you're looking at sort of the how and why, so that your students might not be sort of memorizing dates and places and the names of world leaders, but they're really striving to understand the reasons things take place.
Well, that's a beautiful observation, Chris. The what and where are going to change. Everything is impermanent, and change is the nature of things. So you can have your facts, and that's a good thing to have, be in possession of. But knowing that that's going to change, the how and the why, as you say, are really the fundamental things to have a good handle on. Those are the tools that are going to help you be able to think into the future where the unknown exists. You know, as teachers, we're charged with the impossible. We have to prepare students for something they're going to be doing 10, 20, 30 years from now. We can't even begin to imagine the problems they're going to face, especially in this speeded-up technology in this world we live in today. So we've got to really figure out a way to hand them a tool set, a toolkit that can be universal and used forever, and they can use it to develop their own tools as the problems, the what and the where, will change almost moment to moment these days. So we cannot be locked into simply content and knowledge. We've got to have thinkers and people who think, and they're driven by feeling and understanding of each other and the deeper aspects of situations.
Tell us a little bit about how the game is set up today.
Well, you know, we have a 4-foot by 4-foot by 4-foot plexiglass tower. There are 4 4-by-4 sheets of quarter-inch plexiglass, and they're stacked horizontally above each other with space between. And it towers over the 9-year-olds in my class. I've had it with high school students down to fourth graders, but currently I'm with fourth and fifth graders. And the bottom level is an undersea layer with undersea mining and submarines and sunken civilizations and reefs and endangered species. And then we have a ground and sea level with things we have on our Earth's surface, valleys and towns and cities and mountains and streams and armies and navies also. And an aircraft level on the plexiglass sheet right at about their eye level. And that is that we have giant puffs of cotton that our weather goddess moves around randomly. We have random weather and a random stock market. And also air forces and territorial airspace. And finally, the top layer is outer space. We try to emulate our Earth through this structure. We've got space stations and satellites and black holes and asteroid mining even. And the students are divided into country teams, Prime Minister, Secretary of State, Minister of Defense, and a CFO, I believe, who has to deal with billions and trillions of dollars or yen or euros or whatever we're using. And I choose the leadership, but they choose their cabinets. So we have a United Nations body, arms dealers, and a World Bank also, and also a saboteur, child who's of dual minds, but they're a very integral part of the game.
Now, the saboteur was something you added, about 10 years in. Talk about why you needed this.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting that I had real-world countries at the very beginning of the game, and students were doing okay with solutions, but at one point they began to bog down and not be able to come up with creative ideas, and they weren't getting anywhere, and I wondered why. And it finally occurred to me that they were simply listening to their parents and the news and adult politicians and administrators in the world today trying solutions. They would simply copy them. And, of course, they weren't working in the world very well, and they didn't work in our game. So I fictionalized the countries which opened up the creativity quite a bit. And it really allowed them to go into new territories, new areas. And so what we have now is a kind of a wide open space. And the saboteur I brought into existence because I realized they were sometimes, this was probably during a peaceful area transition in our culture where things were just very oriented to hedonistic pursuits. They simply decided to just declare peace. Let's just sign a treaty, not even fight, forget about all these problems, we're just going to stop. And so I wanted to push them into deeper thinking. So I brought in the saboteur. And not always, but you know that child who's in the office all the time for being in trouble?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that's my saboteur. That's my strongest. You know, you say to that student, you know, you're extremely creative to be able to be in the office all the time for being in trouble. That takes a lot of skill and talent. I want to use your skill set in our game. I want to have you use that skill set. On the surface, you're going to be playing like everybody else to try and win the game. You're going to try and solve all 50 crises together. You're going to try and raise the asset value of every country and win the game. But secretly, through misinformation, misdirection, ambiguities, irrelevancies, you've got a small army of mercenaries and a few ICBMs. I want you to try and destroy this entire game secretly. You can't lie outright, but see if you can do it through conversations. And everybody in the room knows that person is there, but nobody knows who it is. Could be your best friend. So it forces critical thinking in judging and dealing with appearances of things to go much deeper because you just don't know. Everything is unknown. And you really got to be sharper and sharpening that intuition, that insight in every situation. So the saboteur is usually widely celebrated at the end of every game for making it harder.
And ultimately, what you're doing is teaching these young students to think about not only the solution for the present day, but the way things might play out given a variety of circumstances they can't absolutely predict.
Right. And it's about that, not being able to predict. We call it being comfortable in the unknown. Because every moment really is a brand new moment of unknowing. And if we're really paying attention, we can be very, very sharp, very with it, very clear, and deal with things in a fresh new way. Whereas if we're depending upon tradition and convention and not really thinking about things in the moment, we can be, you know, caught in our own limited perspectives and find we're off base. We're not really addressing what's actually happening. So we're trying to, I guess, facilitate them seeing and embracing reality, accepting what actually is, rather than coming up with old perspectives that they bring to something from the past that they might have. This kind of thinking is inherent in complexity, really. And I've designed the game to be as complex as possible. You know, there's a fine line you walk as a teacher. You want it to be so challenging that they almost can't do it to stretch them, but so thrilling that they just can't do without it. Hmm. You know, they buy the fiction. They buy this because it means so much to them. It's an emotional attachment to the curriculum and to learning. You create that kind of attachment, they'll go anywhere with you. And so that kind of drive comes in when they have the students really feel the complexity of the situation. And then they know that there's no way that in the past necessarily works in this moment. So we've got to be at our top creative level, our top critical insight level to be able to solve these problems.
John Hunter is with us. He's a teacher, education consultant, and inventor of the World Peace Game. He's also author of a new book called World Peace and Other Fourth Grade Achievements. We'll come back to the conversation in a moment. If you'd like to be part of it, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, where you can design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in human rights, global studies, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with educator John Hunter. He's the guy who invented the World Peace Game and has talked about it at TED conferences. His new book is called World Peace and Other Fourth Grade Achievements. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think at kera.org. John, what kind of commitment of time is this?
Well, you can ask any teacher. You're probably going to get the same answer. It's a lot. This particular exercise, the World Peace Game, it really came at almost in a flash of understanding. But I remember waking up in the middle of the night with inspiration. You know, you're always thinking about your students. You never really leave them. And I just had this idea. And, of course, you know, I spent the rest of that night and into the early hours sketching it out, diagramming the whole thing. So I would say there's a lot on the front end to building a structure that the students can manage to control, and the structure really becomes the teacher. It's not about me having control. It's about them managing their own structure to inform their own learning. So a lot on the front end in teacher planning and prep, but once it gets started, I have to get out of the way, and it's very difficult for me to let go, to cede control to the students. It's their learning, and they're empowered to make the most of it.
How important is it that you let them fail?
Oh, you know, I thank you for asking that, Chris. I think that's the most important thing, practically. In our life, in our world today, we try to shield everyone from failure. We have almost a moral stigma about it. We expect children, particularly, to get it right the first time and quickly. And those who don't are left behind or shunted aside. And it's a terrible thing to be trying your best in life and to be marked a failure early on. But if I'm understanding things correctly, life, part of life is failure. Part of life is not getting it the way you'd like for it to be the very first time out of the gate. So we build that into the game that there's both sides of that coin, that life has both sides, and we're going to learn how to deal with both sides in a safe and appropriate way here in class now, so that when things don't go well later, you know, you're used to this. You can handle anything. So that failure, the game is designed to fail massively. I designed it to come completely apart of the seams. In the beginning, and there is despair. I know this is coming. I plan for it. And the thing that holds them together through this is our relationship. And that is really the bedrock of our whole educational experience, is the relationship we've built together as a class, as teacher to student, as student with student. And that really gets us through the despair stage until we can learn how to collaborate together and discover how to come to a great stage of mastery of our own learning.
So how is the dynamic different in the classroom when you are serving more as a sort of guide and advisor and less as a fact-to-fact instructor?
Oh, it's much more exciting. I mean, there's noise, you know. You have to be, I guess, prepared to accept some level of louder communication, shall we say. Because, you know, once they get involved and excited, the volume level goes up. And there are times when there are quiet reflections. You know, when we read Sun Tzu, we stop and you can hear a pin drop. But when we get into negotiation and problem solving, all bets are off and the volume level can go through the roof. You know, my fellow teachers, my colleagues next door, I give them all credit for their patience and indulgence with me over the years because, you know, we'll have bursts of noise. But in that chaos, seeming chaos, the students really are digging deep into critical thinking and coming up with unique solutions, innovative solutions, and they're doing it quickly. They're doing it under pressure and stress that they themselves have agreed to, they themselves have brought on, and they themselves love and enjoy. And so that kind of letting go for me, it's a very difficult thing. I know it's coming, and I feel I have some ideas. I've seen this happen before. I know what works and what doesn't, I think. But they prove me wrong so many times. They break my heart because I think this is the way it should be done. I should tell them. But the way I've designed the game, I cannot interfere. It's their game once it starts. I can offer suggestions or questions. These suggestions are very limited, but I can really just question and offer just a limited input that way. So it's really their own experience, and I'm on the sidelines in a way.
Do the students who play this game have to be supremely gifted to succeed?
I hope not, because I'm not, and that would be very difficult. You know, gifted education, when I first started that field, there was a very narrow definition of what giftedness was. Usually you'd take a test or two, and if you passed it, you were gifted. And if you didn't, you weren't, and you never would be. That was the story. Well, now the definition has broadened quite a bit through the works of people like Joe Renzulli at the University of Connecticut and Carol Tomlinson at the University of Virginia, who broadened the definition to say that, you know, giftedness is a behavior that can occur under any circumstance to anyone at any time. So we as schools, as public schools, have to be open and prepared for that possibility. That kind of toolkit, gifted curriculum, must be accessible to every student. So I will see large numbers of the entire school, whether they're formally identified or not, throughout their five-year career in elementary school. I'll see a large percentage of them come through my doors, and frankly, I can't remember who's gifted, who's not half the time, who's identified. So it I think there's a unique tool set or a personality within every student, and they all have something to contribute. I just have to facilitate according to our relationship and my understanding of who they really are.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Tom in Dallas. Hi, Tom.
Who's identified?
So Tom, can you turn your radio off, please? All right, we don't have Tom there. We do have an email question here. This one is from another John who says, what role do tradition and past experience play in creative thinking and innovation?
Well, certainly they're helpful. They can inform and sort of help you come to more quick resolution, I think, and understanding, at least in my experience. But what I find in the World Peace Game is that the less the better. They come into the game, the students who play with absolutely no preparation whatsoever. And other teachers are kind of shy about that. But, you know, we do it because, and some of my colleagues really, really get this and understand it. You know, when they go in fresh with no preconceptions, they're more open to possibility. And they, for example, learn a very high level of diplomatic vocabulary, but they don't have it given to them beforehand. They learn it in context, on their feet, in action. I repeat and reframe the words in different contexts over and over again, and soon they pick it up. Soon they're using it. Soon they're giving themselves homework to find out more about what it is Mr. Hunter is talking about, because we don't really understand. So they're forced into research, their own self-designed research, and they come back stronger and wiser than they ever could if I had just simply decided to assign something to them. So I think that's helpful to have tradition behind us. But there's a point in time when you can sort of step beyond it to a new beginning and not be hamstrung by it. It can be helpful, but it can also be limiting.
What do you need to understand about your students as individuals in order to successfully maybe orchestrate is the wrong word, maybe administer the game?
Well, the first thing I think, and we've talked about it earlier, is you have to really care about them. You have to really know who they are. And, you know, the kind of false caring where they're just numbers on a sheet and, you know, you've got to get them through and you've got pressures to just count the numbers, that is not the kind of caring I think that's helpful. It may be useful for getting certain scores and assessments that way, but to really know these people, you know, you have a lifelong relationship with them whether you ever see them again or not. They're affected by you. They're a part of your life and you're a part of their lives forever. And so that kind of time that you take to get to know who's there and what they really care about and who they really are, I think is a prerequisite for getting any kind of curriculum really fruitfully to develop. And so I'll take the time and get to know who they are. And that seems to go a long way in making any curriculum work better.
What do they learn about self-control?
Well, you know, we adults try to teach them that. We sit them down and we tell them what to do. But I've learned from my teachers that example is better than precept. So I've got to be an example. I've got to do enough self-reflections, enough work on myself to remove my own bad habits and prejudices and biases and skewed perspectives to get that out of the way. And it's a continual struggle every day. But to get that out of the way so that it won't hamper their learning, I won't give them a bad example, so to speak, even in small things. And so by trying to make it possible that there's a space because the teacher is not cluttering it up with these presuppositions and things that they must do and understand are the way reality is, it allows them a chance, hopefully, to get a look at their own understanding, come to their own realizations about the way things are.
You grew up in the segregated South, is that right?
Mm-hmm, that's right, Virginia, Richmond, Virginia.
How does that play into the philosophy you bring to the game, the way you've organized the game, and how deliberate is that, and how much is it something that maybe you've recognized over time almost accidentally?
Yeah, I think it's almost an accidental discovery. I grew up in a segregated town in Chesterfield County, Richmond, Virginia, in the 60s, and my mother was my fourth grade teacher in a segregated school, small school, there's really no choice. I had to go to her class. There were no other teachers. But it was a very quiet year, is what I say about it. I was very careful in that class. But that experience where you were sort of forced in on yourself culturally led to actually the development of some strengths, you know, I have to say. And that some of those strengths were eroded or lost, actually, when the benefit of integration or exposure to the wider world was brought about. So there's a kind of a bittersweetness in some of that, especially for a lot of older African Americans. But I remember I was in the first group of students in my school that were chosen, and it was a community decision who was going to go to integrate the white school nearby. And we didn't know what was going to happen. You know, we had fear. Right around that time, I think America was trying to send a man to the moon, 1969. And I remember feeling like an astronaut, like we were going beyond to the unknown, and we really didn't know if we were going to make it, if we were going to be able to make it back. We had no idea what would happen. We'd heard about things that happened to other people in similar situations, but here we go, we're off. And it turned out, as I say, to be a beautiful experience for me. There were difficult moments, but overall it just opened up the entire world. And my family, that really was the underpinning of the way I teach. My mother and father, Dad was a spatial, tactile kind of thinker, a very broad, deep-minded person. My mom had a reservoir of quiet intuition, and their approach was what I call the quietest school, the shadow school. Mm-hmm. In segregated times, they worked quietly in the dark and behind the scenes to make changes, whereas some people had to take a different route, and they were more in the spotlight and stood out front. So I learned that kind of quietest approach, and it sort of dovetailed nicely with Sun Tzu's quieter or deeper background approach to things sometimes. And that really set the stage for trying to build curriculum or games that, of course, are based on relationship, deep and caring relationships, but also on allowing situations in the quiet stillness of an empty space or a moment of reflection to arise themselves. So my parents' behavior really is inherent in the game, strangely enough.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak to Elspeth in Fort Worth. Hi, Elspeth.
Hi.
Hi.
Hello.
Hello, Elspeth.
I was listening with fascination to your description of the setup that you've been talking about, mm-hmm. and all the three-dimensional layers of history that you're showing and all of that.
Yeah.
I started thinking, what was I like when I was in fourth grade? And suddenly I realized that I couldn't imagine having that much challenge placed on me.
Oh.
You know, I didn't have, I was a kind of a quiet, hold back, think to myself person. Mm-hmm. And I can't imagine a group of students where, I mean, the quick thinkers are going to be the leaders, period.
Well, you know, that it's interesting you bring that up, because we have students who I think were like you, and they were quiet, and they maybe would stay in the back and be deep thinkers, but they weren't going to be out front, you know, spouting off with quick new ideas. So the game has to accommodate that, and we find that the deep thinkers, those who are relatively quiet, first, we don't try and change who they are. We simply facilitate that kind of nature. Hopefully it can be used and brought out and support others, and it does, and it is in the game. That those thinkers often have the greatest insights, and there are avenues for them to actually share those insights, maybe not in intense conversation and negotiations, but in quiet one-on-one consultation with their prime minister or with the Secretary of State or with the UN. And those kind of side conversations, those quiet, gentle backroom chats, really are where they get to shine and do what they do the way they do it best. So we do try and hopefully accommodate students who have a brilliance like you might have had that way. And I'm glad you brought that point out, because it seems like the kids who are loudest might be out front.
So, I mean, I think a lot of people listening think that this sounds extraordinary, but it also sounds like the sort of thing that is very difficult to measure in a standardized test, and it takes a lot of time. Can you talk about, I mean, have you faced uphill battles, or have other teachers you've trained to facilitate the game faced battles in trying to get time spent this way in their schools?
Well, certainly there's a full spectrum of experiences that way. And the directors of programs like mine and school administrators and so forth have to balance. It's a very difficult job. You might be a visionary leader, but you have to balance so many administrative and political pressures in your job. And I've been in schools where administrators were simply pressured to get quantitative data and results and get them up and get them quickly. And in some schools, I've actually resigned. I've had to leave the school because I didn't feel I could teach my best that way. In the World Peace Game and exercises like that, we do assessment. And I think it's even broader and deeper than a grade could indicate. The students co-design the assessment with me, so they have ownership of it. I'm a professional, I think, and so I have input into that process. I make sure it's solid and sound. But, for example, we'll do things where the students will rate or evaluate on a scale of 1 to 10 their effort, their function, how well did their ideas work, and describe how they worked and what were the drawbacks, what were the failures. So it's almost essay-based at some point. They do a full catalog of all resources they look into to build their solutions, their ideas, their problem-solving. They also actually are asked by me to draw a map of their thinking, the sequence of the steps. They can draw it or they can list it, the steps that their mind goes through in solving this problem. Some of my students like to add an emotional map along with it. They want to parallel that with how they felt, and that's okay, too. And then we also use Howard Gardner's multiple intelligences. I teach that to the children, and they check off at the end of the assessment which intelligence they're using mostly, kinesthetic, mathematical, musical, interpersonal, whatever. And if they're stuck in one, I, of course, encourage them to try others in different assessments. But if you do this assessment in any subject, in any classroom activity, 20, 30 times in a year, the students are astounded to realize they've got a mirror of how their mind works, of how they've actually done that year in class. And I do a parallel assessment with them, the same kind, and we get together and come to consensus about what a grade, if we should give one, would be. And the parents see the assessment we've made, the kids have made with me, and they get so much more information. And they're so happy to have that kind of thing. It's much deeper. It takes more time. But we figure it yields more, and the students are prouder of it because they had a hand in developing it.
John Hunter is with us. He's a teacher, education consultant, and inventor of the World Peace Game. He's got a new book out called World Peace and Other Fourth Grade Achievements. We're talking to him as part of KERA's American Graduate Initiative. We'll come back to the conversation in a couple of minutes. You can join us by emailing think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, where you can design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in human rights, global studies, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with educator John Hunter, inventor of the World Peace Game and author of the new book World Peace and Other Fourth Grade Achievements. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. Email address is think@kera.org. And John, even when you have an hour on an NPR affiliate station, it's hard to get into all the complexities of a game like this. But for people who keep wondering, we keep talking about how complex it is. One of the things you have young people deal with is tribes of people whose ethnic loyalty sort of supersedes their national loyalty and so may have a foot in two, you know, across two borders, essentially.
Right.
Things that you know, a lot of adults, including in the State Department where you have taken your students, struggle to deal with.
Yeah, you know, I think I'm trying to reflect human nature, reflect life itself in this game process. The students are going to be facing things that I can't even conceive of, and I'm charged with preparing them for that somehow. And if I teach them only history or only things that have happened before or only the current and present tools and knowledge, you know, they're going to be stuck a bit because they're going to have to invent new ways of doing things. So we're practicing now inventing new ways. We take age-old problems and give them a situation to handle and work out, but they've got to come up with a new way because the old ways really haven't worked so well for us all, not always. And there's a situation where one tribe of people has, I think, ancestral remains that have been discovered in another country, over the border in another country's territory. And their religion decides or declares, according to the way I designed the crises, that land where their ancestors are buried belongs to that tribe, no matter whose country it's in. So you've got a real conflict brewing. And I marvel at what the children did to solve this problem. You know, adults I don't think could ever come to this. But the leader of the large country where the bones were buried, who owned that land technically, was about to go to war with this tribe coming over to claim their rights on their ancestral remains, when suddenly she had an idea, the prime minister of that country had an idea. She asked the United Nations, what happens if I convert to their religion? Now, of course, adults would never take such a big decision so lightly, but the UN said, well, that would probably quell some of the tension. And so she decided to do that, and of course it really did, and they negotiated a fair and equitable settlement, and everybody was happy. You know, I mean, totally out of the box and very unrealistic and more than likely in the world. But I marvel at the critical thinking and then the sacrifice, the personal sacrifice and philosophical range of thinking that had to go into that decision. That's what we want to build, that kind of thinking.
Do you ever have, say, a really rough session on Wednesday and come in Thursday morning and think, I know I'm supposed to introduce the next crisis, but I almost can't bear to do it to these
people? Well, we have a rough session every time. But for me, they're having a great time. But, you know, the crises are all introduced at once. There's 13 pages of 50 interlocking crises and new ones that come up every time a team takes a turn.
Mm-hmm.
So they're completely overwhelmed. It takes 3 hours to go through the entire crisis document together. I completely overwhelm that left brain, that analytical side of the brain we think is existing. And the idea is that they will simply give up. That part of the brain will give up. And the intuitive has to open. The right side has to open up. The creative elements have to come forth because you simply cannot handle that much complexity at once. And so with that kind of leveling effect, having the first crises laid out, you know, they come in from zero,
mm-hmm.
and they immediately go into failure and despair. And so it's a difficult game for me every time because I see them do things I wish they wouldn't do. They're having war. They're going against each other. I've designed it. I intended that. But still, please don't do that. I want to say, but I can't. It's their game. And the shocking thing, the surprising thing is they outsmart me every time.
Hmm.
They show me that they have ulterior motives and motives that go beyond my limited perspective, my limited experience in the game. They come up with a new way of doing things, going through the worst problems rather than avoiding them as I wish they would do.
Including on multiple occasions, you've seen students fall on their own swords.
Yes. Oh, that's a beautiful expression, too. You use that way. And I marvel at the kind of sacrifice, the kind of personal awareness that has to go to helping the group and the relinquishing of the personal satisfaction sometimes in having everything go your own way. One student in the game was a saboteur, a lovely guy, a little redheaded guy, and he loved being the saboteur, just loved causing trouble secretly in the game. And as he was leaving the session one day, he overheard some other students talking about a suspicion that he might be the saboteur. And in the game, you can call someone out. We can have a trial and try that person, and you present evidence why you think that person is. Of course, if you're wrong, you have to pay a $50 million fine for libel and slander. But if you're right, you're awarded $50 million. So it's a dicey thing, but he heard them talking as he was leaving. They're going to accuse him the next day, and so he called me at home. Mr. Hunter, he's on the phone. You've looked up my phone number. Mr. Hunter, they're going to catch me tomorrow, and we have to have a saboteur. We can't stop having a saboteur in the game. It's too important to the game. And I said, well, it looks like you might have to go. I don't know if they catch you. You know, you're going to have to admit that you are. He said, no, we have to. What can I do? And I didn't know what to tell him. I usually never know what to tell him. So he thought for a while, and he said, you know, Mr. Hunter, I'm going to take a chance. I'm going to tell my best friend who's on another team who I am, and I'm going to ask them if they'll be the saboteur if I get caught, and I'm going to swear them in secrecy.
Hmm.
I said, well, that's a huge chance you're taking, because if they decide to not honor that promise, you know, they're going to out you, and you're going to be gone, and it'll all be for nothing. He says, well, I got to do it. And I said, well, sir, that's called falling on your own sword. You've got to simply take the sacrifice here, possibly. And hopefully it works out. Either way, I don't know if you're going to win. And the next day, of course, he was brought to trial. He was found out. And as he was leaving the trial stand to sit back down in his seat, he said, I'll have you all know that there is now a sleeper saboteur that I have named in my honor who will carry on after me because the saboteur is too important to be not in the game. And I was so proud of him that he sacrificed his own enjoyment, his own pleasure, his own role in the game, to keep that alive. He took a risk. You know, he could have just lost it and had no gain at all had the person revealed him. But it worked out, and he was able to do that kind of sacrifice for the good of others.
When battles do break out, one of the things you do is take your students through an exercise where they write home to the families of the supposed war dead.
That's right. If you are a military commander or a country leader and you wager our little plastic soldiers in battle, you know, there's a odds-based coin toss, whether you win or lose. If you lose the battle, those plastic soldiers have plastic parents, fictional parents, and you've got to write a letter to those parents. And it's fourth grade, so you're writing a short condolence letter. I'm sorry, this is what happened, and you explain some of the details very broadly. And for the children, it's just an exercise. It's a little bit sobering. It's not really very, there's no blood involved, so it's not quite so deep. But it does give them a great pause. And we ask one of our parents who happened to be visiting one day, one of the students says, why don't we have a parent read the letter? It's time to read one of those letters. And she picked it up, said, sure, I'll do that. And she began reading one sentence, two sentences, and by the third sentence, she was in tears. Hmm. And I was in tears. And it just, you know, made us understand. It brought us to the understanding that, you know, this is a very serious thing. And I'll just add to that, if I could, Chris, that, you know, we've had so many of our own family members and community members involved in conflict for many years now. I remember once I was visiting a school to give a talk and was picked up at the airport by a young man in a very nice suit, lovely car, nice haircut, shine shoes. I mistook him for a very wealthy, spoiled person. We got in the car, and he said very quietly, you know, Mr. Hunter, I really am glad you have him write that letter. I saw the film, The World Peace and Other Fourth Grade Achievements. I'm glad you have students write that letter home to the parents of troops they lose in battle. And I thought he didn't get it. I thought that was just a nice thing to say. And I said, well, thank you very much. Why do you say that? He said, Mr. Hunter, a year and a half ago before I was a teacher in the school, I was a Marine Corps officer, and I fought in Afghanistan, Iraq, and I myself had to write that letter. I had to make that phone call. I had to go to the homes of some of those parents myself. And he said, if you can do anything to help those children understand the consequences of these things, that, you know, it's not a simple thing, I think you should keep having them write that letter. What an amazing thing to have happen, you know, inadvertently, that somebody who knows and understands more deeply than I ever could affirms even a simple part of a children's game as being of help and service to all of us.
So the cynical part of many people would say, well, it's the American way to take a really complicated, time-consuming exercise like this and have the good people at Milton Bradley or Hasbro package it up and make it into a, you know, sort of 21st century version of Risk. Can you talk about why you've resisted attempts to do a truncated version, to do a one-hour classroom version, and why, in your mind, it really needs to stay this unwieldy to work?
Thank you, Chris. Yes. I have been resistant to the idea of virtualizing it or putting it online or as a smartphone app for forever. And I thought what happens is that the game loses its vitality. The dynamic of the game is based on relationship. It's based on being in the room, up close, person to person, with people, and thinking together in physical form. There's something about the physicality of the game, the spatial, tactile, kinesthetic involvement that kids get that informs their thinking and learning. And I think that would be lost in a simple virtual sideways move into that world. In the interest of legacy, I am considering somehow of trying to share it in a broader fashion than simply me going one-to-one or one school at a time. So there are some folks, some game designers, even a defense contractor at one point contacted us about doing this, and there are some people who do seem to get the core values, the authentic person-to-person relationship. It isn't a game I want strangers to play with each other because the relationship is not there. You can form one, of course, but it has to be there, in my view, for the game to work to its fullest. It's a learning tool. It's not an entertainment application. It's not a diversion. It's not meant to be. And I think it would just devolve into a war game if we simply just put it in a box or put it out online to be played at random. You know, I had some advisors say, you know, John, I don't think you should put it in a box and try and sell it on the over the counter as a game, because, you know, who's going to come into the store and say, oh, yeah, I want that World Peace game, the one that fails massively at first. That's the one I want to take home. You know, you're not going to have a big market for that. So we're trying to keep the integral values of it alive through actually being deeply involved and enmeshed in the immersive experience of it, and not make it more general or more world peace game light We want it to be a visceral thing that really means something, that stays with your DNA forever, really.
So good teachers, talented teachers, nevertheless have different ways of approaching things in the classroom. Can you talk about the qualities required to allow a teacher to succeed with guiding students through this game?
Well, you know, I can only talk from my limited experience. There are great teachers, teachers far better than I am, I've seen and I work with, have many strategies, many ways they do that. I've found that the great ones that I know of, and I try to emulate them, the core technique, the core skill, the core activity is to look into oneself, self-reflection. It's really to try and go deep into seeing who you really are, what you're really made of. I don't mean your favorite ice cream or what band you like, but I mean who at your fundamental level you really are. And then looking at the difficulties, the things that are not permanent and real and useful, and trying to weed them out. Things that I have my own prejudices, my own biases, things that get in the way of student learning. And some of them are so subtle, so I'm continually thrown back on my own practice of trying to root out those problem areas for students in myself first, so that I won't rush to their desk and say, here's the right answer. Let me show you how it's done. This is the way you should do it. Don't you know this is correct? I don't want to be like that. So I've got to at least be quiet enough or introspective enough to see what those things are and then to try and remove them so I can come to the students more clear, more empty, more open to their possibility and not try and color it before they even get their hands on it.
What does victory look like?
Victory is, well, there's jubilation. The children, and you can see it in Chris Farina's documentary, World Peace and Other Fourth Grade Achievements, there is a crescendo of cheering, screaming, yelling, children jumping up and down, rolling on the floor. They have literally saved the world, and they've done it time and time again and in a different way every time. And so it's a thrilling moment, and I think it stays with them. They tell me decades later that it stays with them, that moment. So when every country's asset values increase and all problems have been solved to the satisfaction of our weather goddess, who's sort of a judge and jury on that, then we can call victory. And it's just a thrilling moment. They have reached mastery. They can solve any problem they feel because they've come to a sort of gestalt. They've had a moment that Csikszentmihalyi, the author of the book Flow, calls being in the flow. And they don't want that moment to stop. They really, when they win the game, want to keep on playing.
Hmm. John Hunter is a teacher, education consultant, and inventor of the World Peace Game. His new book is called World Peace and Other Fourth Grade Achievements. John, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you, Chris. A pleasure to be with you.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. We had Lindsay Connect and Janine Kamash on the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is our senior producer. You can learn more about the show, find out about upcoming programs, and download the podcast for free at kera.org/think. We welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.